From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gwyneth Cheesh, Hawa, Toyoksuk Newsom, Salamat for joining the conversation. On today's show, the Northwest ADA Center assists residents in Juneau and around the state. We'll have a conversation about the services that they offer and how you can get involved. Theater at Latitude 58 has a new production this weekend. We'll have a preview of Seven Keys to Baldpate, a mysterious, melodramatic farce. And Litter Free's annual community cleanup is happening this Saturday, April 27th. We'll get all the details on how you can participate in this annual beautification of our capital city. Those conversations, plus Curious Juno Savory Moment, coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Quick note before we begin today, if your child will be 5 years old by September 1st, then it is time to get ready for kindergarten. The Juno School District Kindergarten Registration Day is this Thursday, April 25th from 1 to 5 p.m. at your neighborhood school. Please bring a birth certificate and immunization records to register, and you can find out more information at junoschools.org. Listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Americans with Disabilities Act became effective in July of 1990 and is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. The ADA National Network provides information, guidance, and training and has 10 regional centers around the country. The Northwest ADA is one of those centers and covers Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. And you can find them online at nwadacenter.org. And joining me now in Studio 2K to tell us more is John Doris, continuing education coordinator. Gwyneth Cheesha Yigudi, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasa Iati, how's it going, John?
It's going very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me and making some time for us today.
Yeah, of course. And I know you have a whole team here in Juno, and then you're going to be traveling up to Anchorage. Right. So, yeah.
We arrived Sunday and we've been enjoying Juneau. This is my first time in Alaska. I'm a Florida boy. So this is very different, very new. And it's just absolutely beautiful here. We're here in Juneau till tomorrow. Then we go to Anchorage in the afternoon and then we're there through Friday.
Oh, that's excellent. Okay. Well, let's first, I know I mentioned it in the intro, but let's just first talk about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And can you tell us a little bit more about that and sort of what it is?
Sure. The ADA is a civil rights law. It's a collection of laws to provide very broad coverage of protections in different aspects of life. It's really designed to make sure that obstacles are removed and people really avoid that sense of isolation in different aspects of life. So Title I, for example, deals with employment. So dealing with issues so that people can, you know, get in the door and go to work and then have a job that they can keep. Title II deals with city and state governments, local governments, those entities to make sure that their programs and their services are accessible for the population. And Title III is what people normally think about. That's when you go out and you go to businesses and you're dealing with the public sphere.
In terms of getting into a restaurant or bathrooms or things like that?
Sure. Like if you want to go out to eat, or if you just want to go see a movie, different things, just getting about and enjoying life. Just like all of us, we have different interests, different hobbies. We should be able to access those things all around us.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so great. Okay. And then so now tell me about this national network, the ADA National Network, and they have 10 regions around the country. And so the Northwest ADA Center is one of those regions. Tell me a little bit about the Northwest ADA Center.
Sure. The Northwest ADA Center is we do several different services really meant to reach out to the public so that they understand what the ADA is. So that sounds very broad, and it's meant to be. So anyone that has a question, they can call the 800 number. And oftentimes we'll get questions from businesses that are curious about their services that they're building, or how can they accommodate a customer. And they may get a call from a new client and they may want to say, well, we don't know anything about sign language, for example. Can you give us some direction? Mm. Or sometimes it's somebody that just needs to hold space for a little bit and they need to vent a little bit about what's happening in their life. And you talk to them and you get to what's happening in their life and then help them figure out what's the next step. And that's essentially what all of us want to know, right? How can we solve this problem, or how can we address this issue? So you answer questions, anything that relates to the ADA, people will call, and we encourage that, whether it's a private citizen. We get calls from ADA coordinators in other cities. Sometimes you just need some clarification, or you want to know from somebody that's trained to know about the ADA. What's the answer? Sometimes the answer is it depends.
great answer. It right. depends. Yeah, I need more details.
Right.
Yeah,
you know, that's just life, right?
Yeah.
And then sometimes the answer is, I need to research this. We may not have the right answer at the moment, but give me some time, give me 24 hours, and then we can dig deeper into this and look at the statute, for example, or look at the context and figure out the best course of action.
Yeah, I see. That's great. And I just want to give this number out. It is 800-949-4232.
Yeah, that's a national number. So what's great about that number is you can share that with your friends in different states, because it uses your caller ID to route you to the right ADA center. So if your friend in Orlando calls, they would get the center that covers Florida, for example. Or if somebody in Detroit calls, they would get that appropriate center. So it's a great number to share with everybody, so they, if they ever have questions about the ADA, to just give it a call.
I love that. You can just give that number to everybody who might have a question, and you just follow the prompts and it'll get you to the right place.
Absolutely.
That's cool. It's 800-949-4232. Of course, the website, nwadacenter.org, the numbers, big number right there on the front. I also know that you have an email on here. NWADACTR stands for center, I would assume. But I'm noticing that there's a UW and it's at UW.edu. So are you sponsored by the University of Washington? Are they giving you space to exist, basically?
Well, each of the centers are housed somewhere, somewhere specific, and we're housed at the University of Washington. So the grant funds for the Northwest ADA Center would be directed through the University of Washington. If you were contacting the New England ADA Center, for example, that's housed at Cornell University.
Okay.
So it just depends on the relationships of that particular center in their region and how they've decided to organize.
I see. That's really cool, actually, that they're sponsoring, basically sort of helping out the situation and the centers all around the country. How long has the ADA National Network, and then, of course, the specific one here, the Northwest ADA Center, how long have they been in existence?
Well, I think they've been around for decades, and they...
Since near the beginning of the law, basically?
I think from my understanding of the original creation of the centers was to help people figure out what they needed to do, or, you know, what steps to take. And maybe the emphasis was mainly businesses. There's sort of confusion about, wow, there's this huge law. And even experts don't know everything, right? That's so huge. So you create this center that is a reference to help businesses figure out, well, okay, well, these are the facts that you're giving us. This is the context of your issue. Let's help you figure out what what would be the best steps for you to take to be as compliant as possible? Because sometimes it's not possible for an older business, for example, in a very old building. Maybe they can't remove every architectural barrier, but they can still spend some time problem solving to think about how they can become as compliant as possible, whether it's modifying their policies like curbside delivery, for example, anything that you could do just to brainstorm. And that's what the centers are there to do, is help people brainstorm, be flexible, think about alternatives, and think about, you know, really put the focus on the person. This is a human being that needs some assistance just because they have a disability. What can we do to make this, you know, make it better for them to access your services?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you mentioned, so I think that's interesting that it was sort of founded. I mean, obviously a new law comes into existence and has to become compliant over the years, right? And, you know, like this building we're in right now is pretty old. Mm-hmm. And I know they had to do some work, and there's probably still some work that needs to be done here. And so that's one of those things that if somebody had questions about their business or their old building, what's great is that your organization is helping businesses, but you're also helping individuals too, if they have a question or if they need to point something out, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we understand that it's hard sometimes, mm-hmm. especially for a business that has limited resources. So what are some ways that can be helpful for you to help, you know, problem solve or look for tax credits or look at ways to work around a problem? And this is a great time to point out that this is confidential, that people can feel free to call in. We're not the ADA police. We don't have that authority to go and force compliance with somebody, or we do keep a log. For example, when I'm answering the hotline, I need to know your first name and the state you come from, but those are grant requirements. So you keep a log and you know what's happening. But it's not to say, well, you know, Mary Sue called from XYZ Bakery and I'm going to report. No.
Right. So your name isn't going on a list or anything like that necessarily.
There's nothing like that.
It's all confidential.
Absolutely. We want, I remind people all the time, it is wonderful that you're trying to do better. I encourage people to call in and say, you know, these are our circumstances and we'd love to improve. What are some ideas?
So, John, I'm curious about your title, Continuing Education Coordinator, and sort of your journey. How did you get to this particular position, and what is it that you do?
Well, I am originally from Florida, so I'm a licensed attorney in Florida, and I was ready for a new adventure. So I moved to Washington, and I now live in Seattle. So I wanted to find a position that would be sort of important, doing important work and helping people in a way that was different than being the adversarial lawyer.
Right.
So that's how I ended up with the Northwest ADA Center, was finding my way there through the interview process and landing the job. And I do have an educational background. So part of what I do is trainings. So just last week, I did a training for hotel staff. They needed to know some specifics about the ADA, how it affected hotel industry, and then a very basic overview so that all of them could understand this is why the ADA exists. So always remember, like a lot of times people want to think about the ADA as code restrictions or you know, very technical, highly stuff, but it's important to take a step back and think about why do we have it in the first place. So if you would just begin your inquiry into, well, what's the law? Remember that it's a civil rights law, and this is in place to protect people. And then let's look at, well, what are the requirements that the ADA says? So whether it's a service animal or whether it's very specific, let's say for lodging, for example, their websites need to have very specific information about the accessibility in the hotel. So the Department of Justice has, you know, issued these regulations, guidelines, and said, well, XYZ, these things need to be on a hotel website. So, okay, well, let's talk about that. But it's easier to get them to comply and understand why these regulations and standards exist if they just go back and think about, well, why do we need this in the first place? Because if you're disabled and you're going to a hotel, it would be really nice if you knew before you booked that this hotel would be a better option than the one you did go to because nobody had any information.
Right.
So all of these laws exist really just to help people.
Yeah. I love that you've come from the dark side to the good side, basically. from, as you said, adversarial lawyer to a good nonprofit and doing that work and that education. But it must be nice to have sort of the lawyering background just because you understand law, right? And you can then sort of navigate and help people to sort of the language can sometimes be a little, you know, wherewith and withal and where has and all that, right? So,
Right. Yeah,
you can break it down for folks.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, it does feel better as a human being to have made that transition.
So now this was the first I'd heard of the Northwest ADA Center. And so I'm curious about sort of the footprint that you have in Alaska. I know that you're here to meet with folks, and I know you've met with some folks here in Juneau. Who are you meeting with, and what is the goal of this trip that you all are making?
Well, we're wanting to establish relationships so that people understand what resources are available and we have a better picture of the resources available here. We have the hotline, and we'll get phone calls, we'll get emails from people who live in Alaska, and oftentimes they're from people that are in very remote areas. Mm. So that can be really difficult. I'm thinking right away of one particular person. It was a parent who was taking care of their son who needed a lot of services, but they just lived in a very remote area of Alaska. So calling us can help them sort of filter and find and figure out, who are the best people for them to call based on their geography. And then by us coming here to figure out, okay, well, what's really happening in Alaska? Who are the people that are performing specific services that are directed, and who has resources to provide these services? So it's helpful for us to have come to meet people in local organizations like SAIL, and some of the attorney groups, community foundation, and then met with city officials to see, well, what are the issues that are affecting the population here in Juneau? What kind of trainings can we do to help facilitate understanding and help people understand the ADA and then understand their own obligations? For example, if they have a service animal or if they have an emotional support animal, and what should you be saying and how should you be, you know, I was about to say existing in life, but that's not really the right thing. If I have an emotional support animal, I shouldn't pretend that I have a service animal, because those two are very different and that can create some problems and unnecessarily. An emotional support animal is important. And the Fair Housing Act, for example, FHA, does have regulations that are very specific for service animals, but that's not the same as the ADA. So it's helpful to get the education out, find out what kind of education is necessary so that we can plan some trainings and really continue to promote the 800 number for people to call us and ask us any questions.
I love that. And I was talking to one of your colleagues before the show here, and I guess in some of your meetings that you've had already in Juneau, service dogs or service animals, not just dogs, obviously, but service animals has been a theme. What is it about? Are we lacking in the service animals here in Juneau?
I think sometimes people want to call their emotional support animals a service animal. Service animals generally are dogs. Miniature horses can be a service animal. That's an accommodation. So there are definitely reasons why a miniature horse would be a better option. For example, it could carry more or could pull more weight, and miniature horses would live a lot longer. There are many people that have service dogs, and they'll tell you, you know, over my lifespan, I've gone through three or four, because they reach a point where they're just, you know, they're just done.
Not able to do service.
Right.
Right.
So service dogs, miniature horses, those can be service animals, and a person doesn't have to disclose their disability. If a business wants to say, well, is this a service animal? Yes. They can't go much further beyond that. They can ask, well, what task has this animal been trained to do? And I can say, well, it will alert me to an impending seizure, for example. Mm. So that kind of task is important to be aware of, because sometimes people will say, well, show me what your service animal can do. And that's not allowed. And if I'm not having a seizure, then my service animal is not going to be able to perform that task. So it's not necessary to perform a task to say, well, look, here's what it does.
Right.
And sometimes people get confused about paperwork. There's a lot of people, or there are some people online that will want to sell you paperwork that says, this is a certified service dog. Or if you go online and find a vest for an animal that says service dog. Well, the Department of Justice has made it very clear you're not required to have any kind of paperwork. And you could train a service animal and not have gone through some kind of institute. People oftentimes, because there's such a waiting list and there's so few service animals, sometimes they train them themselves, and it's possible. So were they going to, get on their computer and print out a certificate that they generated themselves? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
So right.
You just wouldn't have to have.
Well, that's the kind of thing that the phone number can help out with, right? If somebody had a question about that and they're like, how do I get the correct documentation, or I went to a business and they asked me some questions that I was uncomfortable with. And so maybe that business might need some training, or that individual might need some help in figuring out and navigating that particular question. Right. So that's kind of cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. We still get questions every once in a while from somebody that went to a restaurant, for example, and the owner said, well, where is your papers?
Yeah.
And you don't have to have,
really shouldn't papers. Have to prove that you have papers, right? Like right. That's kind of interesting. The number again is 800-949-4232. You can share that around the country. It'll direct you to the correct center in that region that can help you answer questions. And if you're a business, or if you're another individual who has questions about how you can become more ADA compliant, or how you can figure all that stuff out, that's a great thing to do. If you're an individual and you have questions, or if you have a friend who you might be able to help out by calling this number, 800-949-4232. Or you can go to nwadacenter.org. That's the Northwest ADA Center. They're doing all kinds of good work, providing information, training, and guidance on the Americans with Disabilities Act. And they cover Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. This particular center, but it's all over the country, the whole national center for that. So that's really great. Well, John, thank you so much for coming in. Gunnath Cheesh for being here. I know you guys are here for a couple more days and you're up to Anchorage, and you're gonna have a good time up there. It's a pleasure to have you here, and we look forward to hearing back. Like when you have some trainings or when you have some things that are coming up, let us know. Be happy to have you all back on the show and talk about those particular things. So Gunnath Cheesh for coming in today.
Thank you, sir, for having us. It was great to be here.
Absolutely. Okay. Up next, Theater at Latitude 58 is performing a classic melodramatic farce from 1913 this weekend. We'll find out about the 7 keys to Baldpate next here on Juno Afternoon from KTOO. But first, this week's Curious Juno about where does all that recycling go here in Juno?
Most days of the week, Juno residents pull up to the City Recycling Center in Lemon Creek and methodically separate the plastics, tin, glass, aluminum, and cardboard they've used over the past week. Then they get back in their cars to continue their errands, which probably involve a stop at Costco. Over the years, several listeners have asked KTOO where all that recycling ends up. A few even wonder if it's really getting reused, or if some of it ends up in a landfill. And what about contamination? Can putting an item in the wrong bin cause Juno's recycling to end up in the trash? In this Curious Juno, I attempt to get to the bottom of all that plastic and glass, figuratively speaking. Let's start with the basics. How good is Juno at recycling? Well, according to Stuart Ashton, the city's RecycleWorks operations manager, pretty darn good. We're standing outside the city facility on a rainy day.
Juno residents generally are absolutely excellent when it comes to contamination in their recyclables.
He says Juno sees a very small amount of contamination in the recycled materials shipped out.
Our stuff is considered the gold standard. They will actually take it, and if they've got a tour coming up, they'll bring that stuff out and for observation because it's so good. It's that good.
The tours he's talking about are at a recycling facility in Tacoma, Washington. That's where Juno's plastic, paper, aluminum, and tin end up. It's run by Waste Management, the same national company that runs Juno's landfill. Juno's curbside recycling program is run by Alaska Waste, and it does have a higher contamination rate, probably because there's less oversight compared to the open-air building where people toss materials into the correct bin.
Here we have lots, it's very, very public. There's lots of other people and friends and just people helping each other recycle here, as well as the labor provided through our contract by Waste Management. They have a people here that assist and correct and help people, show them where they're supposed to go.
Curbside or not, all recyclables in Juno end up at the city's facility. Most of it eventually leaves town, but not all of it. Waste Management actually grinds up all of the glass. Ashton says they use it in place of gravel for road remediation or for perforated pipes used to capture methane as it escapes the landfill. In short, it keeps it less stinky.
It is our best reused material in this town, from my perspective.
As for the rest of it, it all gets condensed into big cubes by the baler. That's the huge machine inside the building. Then it's shipped by barge to Waste Management's Tacoma facility. They process about 180,000 tons of material per year. Ashton says Juno makes up about 1,400 tons of that, or 0.007%. Jackie Lang with Waste Management's Northwest Region says there's always room for improvement, but Juno's reputation for good recycling outshines many of the communities they serve.
We see that in the material that we receive from Juno. We see that residents and businesses are working hard to put the right material in the right container.
In Tacoma, industrial-scale machines sort Juno's recycling before it gets shipped to end markets. In a video shared by Waste Management, materials fly by on conveyor belts inside a huge warehouse.
Plastic sorted at this particular recycling facility end up in fleece-type clothing and backpacks. Some plastics are made into rigid plastic products like plastic buckets or maybe laundry baskets or storage bins. Tin cans are recycled into rebar. Aluminum cans become new aluminum cans.
Cardboard boxes become new boxes. Water bottles become new water bottles. You get the idea. Lang says contamination does happen. Soggy or greasy pizza boxes, for example, end up in the trash. She didn't provide any numbers for how much of the recycling Juno sends south gets turned into new products and how much ends up in a landfill. But she said because of its quality, most of it gets recycled. The market for processed recycling fluctuates constantly based on global supply and demand. Lang acknowledged that it dipped in the past year, but she says Waste Management recently invested millions of dollars to improve equipment at its Tacoma facility to make sure that more of what they receive does get recycled.
Recyclables that arrive at our recycling center are sorted and shipped to manufacturers who are waiting for that material. So the demand is reliable and steady.
And that's good news. More and more headlines and studies warn us about the threat of microplastics in our environment. Recycling has long been touted as the way to avoid plastics pollution. But a recent report from the Center for Climate Integrity investigates how the oil and plastics industries used recycling as a public relations tool for decades, despite privately acknowledging that it often costs more to recycle than it does to make new plastic. Back in Juno, Ashton says it's vital to remain conscientious about recycling because it diverts waste away from the local landfill. The dump is expected to be full in the next two decades, raising questions about what Juno will do with its trash in the future. In Juno, I'm Adeline Baxter.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Seven Keys to Bald Pate by George M. Cohen was a 1913 play based on a novel by Earl Durr Biggers. It was a big hit. It ran in New York for a year, more than a year, I think, and was adapted into a film multiple times, like six or seven times. Plus, it's been a radio play, and now it will run this weekend, produced by Theater at Latitude 58. It will run April 25th through the 28th at McPheeters Hall. The 25th through the 27th, the shows are at 7 o'clock, and then on Sunday, it is at 2 p.m. And here to share about it are Karen Allen, the director, Aaron Saha, and Elizabeth DiBartolo. Say your name for me, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth DiBartolo.
DiBartolo. Okay, there we go. That's good. I was practicing beforehand and still messed it up. Well, Gunath Chishaye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you all here. Wasa Iati, how's it going? You're in the middle of tech, probably.
Yep.
You know, it is going, I hate to jinx, I don't want to jinx this, but it is going remarkably well. This show has been a joy from beginning to end. Last night, some cast members were sitting out in the house watching in between scenes and were cracking up because their peers were so funny and so alive.
I love that. Well, you know, they say, you know, what is it? Bad dress rehearsal, great opening night, right? So, and we're opening on Thursday, mm-hmm. right? So we're running Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7 o'clock, and then on Sunday at 2 p.m., and then you're going to be at McPheeters Hall. So it's really fun. And Aaron, you're the stage manager.
Yes.
And so tech is always a fun time for stage managers. Tell us what happens for a stage manager in tech, just for the people who may not understand.
For me right now, I'm running the light board, watching for cues of the people on stage. Everybody's mostly got their blocking down already, so I don't have to worry about that or calling for lines because everybody's so on right now.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And so the stage manager, you sort of sit in the booth and you kind of like are watching the show, and there's cues, right? There's tons of cues because you probably have sound cues and there's light cues and all that stuff, right?
I only have to worry about light cues. Sound cues are being helmed by some of the actors off to the side of the stage. We're doing all sort of...
We're doing old school practical effects
for
the sound.
Oh, I love that.
Because it is a play that premiered in 1913.
Yeah.
And so we are doing all of our sound effects with things that existed and were commonly used for Foley and radio in 1913.
Do you have one of those, like, the two blocks to slam a door kind of sound and all that stuff?
We have that kind of thing. We have a special kind of contraption made out of cardboard and paper to do gunshots.
Nice.
We've got bicycles. Bells. There's all kinds of fun things in there.
I love that.
Making the sounds. But we thought, because of the style of the play and the era of the play, that rather than running recorded sound cues, we would have a lesson in practical effects.
I love that. Well, Karen, tell us a little bit about this play, Seven Keys to Bald Pate. Give us what you can of the synopsis.
Well, the play starts in Bald Pate Inn atop Bald Pate Mountain in the dead of winter in a horrible storm.
And, sounds good so far.
Right? I mean, everything good happens that way.
Yeah.
And the caretaker and his wife are waiting because they received a telegram in the middle of the night that an author was coming to visit them. And it turns out he has made a bet with the owner of Bald Pate Inn that he will lock himself in with the only key in existence to Bald Pate Inn and write a novel about Bald Pate within 24 hours. So they lock him in and they leave. He starts writing, and less than an hour later, there's a key in the front door and Elizabeth walks in. And suddenly there is graft money hidden in the safe. There are hitmen, corrupt politicians, railway magnates, a hermit who dresses as a ghost and a professional blackmailer, not to mention the chief of police, all running around chasing after some money.
Oh, wow.
And there is at least one surprise ending.
I would say when you said there was, you know, only the only key, but then the play is called Seven Keys. So I'm thinking there's got to be something that's going to be happening there. So is it sort of like these characters come in, you mentioned a few of them, and they're sort of disrupting this fellow, or they're causing, is it, because when I was reading the synopsis, I was like, oh, is it kind of like, you know, Christmas Carol, where he's being visited by different people, but they're not ghosts.
No, none of it has, you don't think anything has to, well, there is a ghost. I mean, there is Peter's the Hermit, who dresses as a ghost to scare tourists.
Oh, no.
And literally wears a ghost costume all the time, because that's what Peter's does.
Right.
But no, they are all here about their own errands.
I see.
The money's being hidden in the safe, and someone is trying to steal the money out of the safe. They're trying to buy a railway franchise. There's a young reporter trying to cover the story. She's there with her chaperone. But everybody has a stake in this. Everybody has a hidden motive, and everybody wants to get their hands on that money.
I love that. So,
and the poor author is stuck in the middle.
Stuck in the middle. So, Elizabeth, and who do you play?
Okay, I play John Bland, and he is the right-hand man of a millionaire who is another character in the show. He's the president of the railway that is around the area they're in, and he basically does this millionaire's dirty work. So he has been sent to drop off the graft money to the safe, and then that's kind of where all chaos breaks loose.
I love that. And chaos is a good word, because I mentioned two words and I just want to talk about those words a little bit. So melodramatic or melodrama, and then farce, right? And this is sort of billed as kind of both, right? Because and they're a little bit, they're different things. I mean, people might recognize a melodrama if you ever go to like a Ren Fair, or if you go to, you know, some kind of, you know, wild show at a bar or something like that. It might be very melodramatic and sort of, you know, twisting of the mustaches and the tying of the person to the railway tracks, things like that, right? And then a farce is a little bit different, though. Farce is sort of where it takes the, you know, kind of explodes. Everything is exploded, right? Everything's bigger than life. Everything's crazy. Things are wild. So, Karen, as a director, how are you sort of managing all of these forms into this play with the folks that you have?
Well, I mean, I've spent a lot of time studying the genres and studying theater history and dramatic literature, and my degrees in English literature. So, you know, I've got a good background in this. And with these guys, we spent a lot of time kind of taking it apart. We watched some farces early on to kind of get the feel, because so much of the difference between farce and tragedy is pacing and energy and finding the heartbeat of this show and learning about the timing of different things, learning about when the whole cast moving in unison just ties a joke together, learning about the moments where a small thing that isn't even in the script, like the cops and their coffee cups, suddenly it brings a whole scene to life. And so these guys, I mean, they're fearless. This is a multi-age cast ranging from 12 to old enough that they don't have to tell me. And you know what? They are completely fearless. They are playing a wide array of characters, and they're always willing to reach just a little further and to analyze what they're doing and try a little bit harder and find another way to do it. The other thing is, acting is reacting. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're funny when you're acting and then you go dead between your lines, there's nothing to it. And they have been so wonderful about supporting each other as performers and giving each other the reactions they need to take it to the next level. So it just goes way over the top, and it is so much fun.
It seems like one of those opportunities, Elizabeth, as an actor, to just kind of go hog wild, right? Like any instinct, any impulse you would have, you can probably do in this kind of a show, yeah?
Yeah, it's really great, because Karen has given us the freedom to kind of get our own take on it and try new things. And a lot of the time they work and they add just that much more to the show to make it all the better. And it's super fun while also making the show interesting. So it's really great.
That's awesome. So how did you get involved in this production?
Well, I've been doing shows with this theater group since 2018.
Okay.
And I've been doing shows with them since then. And I just decide to do every show with them because they're a really great group to be around. They're a great group of people, very supportive of everything. And it's always fun, whatever show we're doing. So I always just take a shot at the show because I know it's going to end up being super fun.
I love that. And Aaron, how about you? How did you get involved?
I've also been...
You were actually in our very first show.
I was a really long time ago. So I've been involved in the theater in various capacities for quite a while. I had
12
was
years,
acting
the whole run of the theater.
With the troupe on occasion, and I've done stage managing the last two shows. I've enjoyed both aspects thoroughly.
Yeah. What's it like to watch these actors, you know, go wild a little bit?
It's a lot of fun. It's a great show. They all bring a lot to the table. I've been laughing the entire run. If I try to keep it a little low key just to not disturb them.
I can see a stage manager, one hand on the light board and one hand on your mouth, like trying to make sure that you don't laugh kind of thing.
It's exactly like that.
That's pretty funny. And it's interesting, Karen, because this seems like it's a play perfect for our time in the sense that, you know, sometimes we just need to laugh. You know, sometimes we just need
to. The world is incredibly hard right now.
Yeah.
And this play is hilarious and it just takes you away from your troubles for a while. But that said, it has some messages and it drives them home pretty hard. You know, it talks about tropes and stereotypes and audience expectations. And it talks, it's in some ways, it's a fun defense of genre fiction.
I see.
People like to look down on genre fiction as though it is somehow a lesser art form. And it isn't.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you mentioned that there's at least one surprise in the show.
At least.
And I'm sure all the characters, because it would seem to me that every time a new character shows up, it's a new surprise, right?
Like the stakes go up with every new person who comes onto that stage.
Yeah, that's really fun. And so in Theater at Latitude 58, you're talking about it's been in existence for 12 years or so. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the theater in terms of the goal, because it sounds like you've got ages from young to old, you know, or that young to younger, however we want to say that. And it's sort of it's really about community. Yeah,
that is what we are at the core. We were founded in 2012 by Cinnamon Simpson, and we are an educational all ages theater. We teach theater craft from every angle we can manage. So we teach acting, costuming, directing, stage management, light design, sound design, props, sets. We try to involve our students in every part of what we do. And so people will frequently act for a while and then decide that maybe what they'd really like to do is learn how to design lights or learn how to stage manage. And so we try to facilitate that. We also work very, very hard to be a genuinely inclusive theater. Mm-hmm. If you want to perform with us, you can perform with us. If you make it through the audition process, and it's a fun audition process, I think, we usually laugh a lot, you can have a part. No questions asked. We always include everyone. We support neurodiverse actors. We support actors with physical disabilities. We try to make sure that everybody who wants to perform is given a space to do that. At our best, that's what we do.
That's great. Yeah, that's really fun. It sounds like such a great show. Do we want to shout out some of the other cast members? Either Karen or Elizabeth, you want to talk about some of your cast mates or can we know some of the names of some of the other folks in it?
I could talk about a few, probably.
I can fill in after she's done.
Yeah. Okay. First, I'll probably talk about James. I'm not quite sure his last name.
James Dietz.
But he plays William Howell McGee, and he is the writer in this story who's kind of in the middle of it all, who made the bet with the owner of Bald Pay Inn. And James is just really, he's really great. He's really funny. And everything he does with his character is just really, it works so well. And he puts so much effort and emotion into it. It just really brings the character together. And
He's got kind of an old school Danny Kaye feel to him as a comic actor.
Mm. Yeah.
That sort of long, loose-limbed, agile comic.
Mm. Yeah. And he's on stage almost the entire time.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the largest line load, and he's managed to get it all straight, and he's funny throughout.
Oh, yes. He's just very impressive, and it makes working the show that just that much better and that much like easier to put emotion into your own character, because it's easier to react to somebody who puts effort and emotion into their character.
Well said.
Yeah. And then we have, oh, there are so many of them. We have Emily Elligott, who is doubling as Mr. Quimby, the caretaker, and as Mayor Crooked Mayor Cargan. We have Emily Mesh, who is hilarious in all forms, and she plays Mrs. Rhodes, who is the chaperone of Mary Norton, the young reporter played by Elena Truitt. We have Maya Breedlove playing Myra Thornhill, the professional blackmailer. We have Sadie Curtis playing Lou Max, who is the mayor's Guy Friday, to use a very old-fashioned phrase. You don't hear that very much anymore. Let's see. We have Zafira Keel playing Thomas Hayden, the corrupt railway magnate. We have Lynx Alper playing the owner of Baldpate Inn. We have Kylie Weitzel playing Mrs. Quimby and doubling as a police officer. We have Dane Kessler as Chief Kennedy, the chief of police. Have I missed anybody?
I don't think so.
I think we got them all. I don't want to leave anybody out
because
and every one of them is hilarious.
Yeah. It's so great. It sounds like such a wonderful show. Seven Keys to Baldpate by George M. Cohen. It was started in 1913. And this weekend, you can see it at the produced by Theater at Latitude 58. It opens this Thursday at McFeeters Hall. It runs this weekend only. One weekend only. So you got to get your tickets, and you can get those at jahc.org. That's the Jack, of course. Go to jack.org to get your tickets for this production of Seven Keys to Baldpate by Theater at Latitude 58. Karen, Aaron, and Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming in today and sharing about this. It sounds like you guys are all going to have a really good time this weekend. That's what it sounds like to me. So break a leg.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Gunnar the Cheese for being here today. Up next, we have the Juno Community Cleanup via Litter Free is happening this Saturday. But first, a savory moment. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Step in to the savory moment. There's nothing like a signature sauce, marinara, chimichurri, beurre blanc, to make you feel accomplished in the kitchen. But possibly the easiest signature sauce is teriyaki. The Japanese word teriyaki comes from teri, which means shine, and yaki, to grill. In other words, teriyaki is a glaze for grilled foods. It yields a sticky, fragrant finish when sugars break down and morph into new and wildly interesting flavors and aromas. Let's create your own signature teriyaki sauce. First, pick a sweetener: white or brown sugar, honey, concentrated juices like orange or pineapple, or even a little molasses. Use just one sweetener or experiment with a combo. Next, something acidic. Rice wine vinegar is a good start. Or branch out with a Filipino style like Sukong Iloco or a Chinese black vinegar. What about pineapple vinegar from Mexico? And salt. Soy sauce, tamari, or fish sauce all fit the bill beautifully. Last, but definitely not least, a little something from the spice cabinet to make people scratch their heads and wonder. Lemongrass, star anise, cinnamon, bay leaf, smoky Aleppo pepper flakes. This is the flourish on your signature. bring your mixture to a boil, allowing the sugars to melt and the spices to infuse the liquid. Want to feel like a real pro? Get yourself one of those plastic squirt bottles from the kitchen store. Fill with sauce and sign your name to your next meal. Find the full recipe for an all-purpose teriyaki sauce you can signatureize at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clenady have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The 2024 Juno Community Cleanup will be this Saturday, April 27th, starting at 8 a.m. It is organized by Litter Free, and Lori Sika is here to tell us more about it. Gunath Chish for being here today. Wasa Iati, how are you?
I'm really good, and thank you very much for having me here.
Of course. Well, this is a wonderful community project. It's been going on for years. Mm-hmm. So how many years have... I know that the organization has been around since 85 or so. How many years has this particular community cleanup thing been going on?
Well, we like to think it's been going on since 1916. Well,
I know when, you have that great quote
when
on your website.
The mayor told us to go out and clean up town.
Right. Clean up the town.
Yeah. But as an organization, Litter Free is a nonprofit, and we've been doing it since 1985 as a group.
Yeah. Wow, that is amazing. And it always happens sort of this, is it always like the last Saturday in April, kind of?
Well, we used to do it the Saturday before Mother's Day, which is usually the second week in May.
Okay.
And, you know, we started thinking that the cruise ships were coming earlier and earlier.
They are.
And the weather is always gorgeous, you know, usually at the end of May, end of April.
End of April, yeah.
So we thought, why don't we just push it back a little bit?
So splitting the difference between, because now we've got these like once a week boats that start like early April and stuff like that. And then so I see you put it in there. You pick a Saturday that's useful and then do that. So it's not necessarily always the same Saturday.
No, we look for the low tide.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. That's great. So tell us a little bit about what, for those who may be new to Juno or who haven't participated in this before, what is the Juno Community Cleanup?
It is a very simple event. We just invite people to go to one of our bag sites, pick up a bag, fill it with trash from an area that they choose on public land. They put the trash in the bag, put the bag on a main roadway, and then our volunteers will go around and pick up the bags and take them to landfill.
That seems easy. Right?
Isn't it?
I think that seems really good. I do want to point out, because I know on your website you make a point of this, to say this, which I think is important. Public lands. Yes. Like, you're not going to pick up your neighbor's trash or going onto somebody's property or anything like that. We're talking about roadways, parks, public areas.
Yes. We don't have permission to go on private land. We avoid that. Because there's plenty of trash that's on public spaces, which is everything from sidewalks, streets, the gutters alongside of streets get a lot of trash, bus stops, parks, trails, beaches.
Yeah. Those middle areas of roads sometimes end up with stuff in them, right? And there probably is some safety concerns too, right? In terms of what you ask people to make sure, especially if you're around roads and stuff, I would imagine.
We're really trying to focus on safety this year. We had a little problem with some enthusiastic cleaners last year out on Egan Highway, and the high speeds are dangerous. So we asked people to try to pick a road that's 45 miles per hour or under.
Mm-hmm. And no zooming across, right? Don't zoom across. Because I know you get those young folks, they get excited and they want to try to help out and might get a little too excited.
Well, the state has a great program called Adopt a Highway. And if groups are in an Adopt a Highway group and have adopted a section of Egan, we encourage them to go out and do that. But if you're not familiar with that program, we ask people to stay off of the high-speed areas of Egan and just focus on the other areas of town. There's plenty of trash out there.
There's so many other areas, right? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So let's talk about this. So you gave us the general sense of it. Let's talk about these bag details. So you can start picking up your bags early as of Thursday at a couple different places, right? And what are those places?
We'll have some bags available for people who want to get a head start available Thursday and Friday at the Amazing Bookstore at the Airport Mall in the Valley.
Yeah.
Their hours, I think, are 10 to 6. Mm-hmm. And then at downtown, we have a new location for a bag site. It's at the Picture This. It's a frame shop, and they're located in the Marine View Building on Ferry Way. And she's going to be open her regular hours and have bags there. And then she'll also be open on Saturday morning as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And Friends of the Library is such a wonderful organization, the Amazing Bookstore. And of course, so you can either get it there in the Valley or downtown at Picture This, which I think is great. And that's if you want to get a head start or pick up the bags early, like you don't want to get up too early on Saturday or something like that.
Right. And we ask people, though, to please don't set the bags out until Saturday for pickup. So if you go out and pick up early, kind of hang on to them somewhere and then put them out on that main road on Saturday.
Saturday.
We don't really want cars to hit them or birds get in them. Well,
the bears are out. We saw a bear recently, so they're coming out. So it's good to do. Now, some of the other bag distribution sites, they're all over, right? And this is where you can start picking those up on Saturday morning.
Saturday morning, 8 to 10 in the morning. And those are at Douglas Library, the Duck Creek Market, Western Auto, Super Bear, Fred Meyer, Foodland IGA, the Picture This Store, Sunny Point, and Forbidden Peak Brewery.
And that is on Saturday morning. You pick those up between 8 and 10 a.m., right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you go pick up trash, and then you leave the bag out. And then, and this is a really, I want to mention this because I think that Capital Recycling and Disposal is accepting that trash and as a donation, and it's a big deal. And it is not a time for folks to throw in their extra comforter or, you know, extra chair that they might have trying to get rid of that on that day. This is really about picking up the trash around town. And so it's really, really great. And it's all happening on Saturday. And of course, you can go to litterfree.org for more information. But quickly, before we have to end, Lori, can you tell me just a little bit about your Youth Litter Patrol? How do people get involved in that?
Yeah, that's the other program that Litter Free runs. And what it is another simple program where we coordinate with student youth groups that are trying to raise funds for anything from sports to theater to travel for religious groups or anything that's basically school-related education, nonprofit. These groups can get bags from us, head out to another trashy area on public property, pick up the area, and then in coordination with the landfill, we give them access to take the bags there, and then we pay them money for their efforts.
That sounds great. Yeah, that sounds really good. That's and you can great. Find out all that information on litterfree.org. Yeah. Okay. Litterfree.org is the place to go. Well, Lori, thanks so much. It's the annual Juno Community Cleanup, and it's all happening by Litterfree, and you can find out all the details at litterfree.org. It has the list of bag sites and all that stuff. So thanks so much for coming in. Gunath Cheesh.
Great.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, a preview of this Friday's Early Learning Fair, plus a look at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum summer season, and a check-in with the Juno Chamber of Commerce. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of Juno Afternoon, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Thanks, and have a glorious Juno evening.